to Thoughtcast, an interview program on authors, academics, and intellectuals. Also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiyah. With me today is Ilan Stavins, a man of many passions and personas. He's known as the Tsar of Hispanic cultural and literary studies. He worships books, languages, and words. He's multilingual, transnational, but he's also an outsider. Ilan was born in Mexico and raised there, but he lived apart, in a secluded, self-isolating community of diaspora Jews. Today, Ilan is a Jewish-Mexican-American who exists in a state of cultural exile. As such, he's well-suited to the life of the critic. And while Ilan may not yet have found his home, it's clear that he's arrived. He's the Lewis Sebring Professor of Latin American and Latino Culture at Amherst College in Massachusetts, the host of the public television program La Plaza, Conversations with Ilan Stavins on WGBH in Boston, and the author of more books than even he can count. Or can you, Ilan? What are we up to now?
Probably 30. Thereabouts.
About thereabouts.
Thereabouts.
Right. Well, I count you as the author of one book of fiction, 9 nonfiction titles ranging from The Hispanic Condition, which was pretty controversial, to your memoir, On Borrowed Words, to Spanglish, The Making of a New American Language, which was, again, controversial. You speak Yiddish, Spanish, English, Hebrew. You're the editor of 8 anthologies and 4 critical editions, at least. And your latest book is called Dictionary Days. To me, it's about the power of words and their meaning, and also the competing urges to, on one side, pin them down, and on another, to let them breathe, to let them develop on their own.
Indeed, that's exactly what the book is about. The evasiveness of language and, on the other hand, the need for us to make it tangible, to make it stay with us, not disappear. The power that words have on us and the power that we have to change the world and the words. And the ambivalent relationship that I have with various languages and with the various volumes, books that convey to me the authority of those languages. Dictionaries in particular, with which I have had a love affair for many years, that includes moments of intense passion and devotion and making them part of me, and also moments of utter rejection, of realizing that dictionaries are tyrannical, that they force us to use words in a particular way and not in another, and that they create class structures and thus make us humans not come together but separate, move apart. Probably the most dangerous and double-edged tools that we have, words, and at the same time probably the most democratic and free instrument that the mind has.
Can you give me an example of some words that you feel have this sort of double edge to them?
I think the words that I would bring to mind, to your mind, are words that are rather common. Think of the word woman, the word God, the word Jew, the word anger. Those are words that keep on changing, and I feel infatuated with those changes. I like words to change. I think that is proof that the human mind is not static, is in constant move, and that although we believe that words are always going to be there for us, and they are, the words keep on being transformed, and we need to catch up.
Let me take the word Jew. And I can assume that the word Jew has a more positive connotation now.
Absolutely. In the Spanish language, most definitions that we have in the 17th century refer to Jews as heretics, or those that do not pledge to their true faith, the faith of Jesus, and instead go on the road of the devil. And as we move on, we realize that dictionaries have given up on the idea of Jew and Jews and Judaism as a religion exclusively, and move more into an ethnic or minority group or a cultural manifestation, or maybe even a national spirit.
You've said in the past that American Jews in particular are complacent.
American Jews have become complacent because they are, on the one hand, a success story, an admirable story of assimilation, integration, and a upward climbing. But this has come at the expense of connecting with other diasporas and with other parts of the world. My impression is that American Jews get the sense that the world rotates around the country, around the United States, and around them as a people. And here I am myself, a member, and not only a witness, but a participant of what goes on, and also hopefully a voice of dissent and of encouragement to see things differently.
You use the word dissent, that you often are the voice of dissent, of critique. Some of the words you've used to describe yourself are a wandering Jew, a hyphenated American, an imposter, a chameleon. Why are you so hard to pin down?
Well, why this obsessive need of pinning down people?
You're the guy who writes the dictionaries.
Well, I am,
too. And is interested in definitions and words and meaning.
And the one that sabotages the effort as well. And so I would say that having a single face, a single mask, is like speaking only one language. That the schizophrenia might be indeed a psychological illness, but the multiplicity of identities is not. And to be able to travel from one culture to another, from one linguistic milieu to the next, from one discipline to another, is for me a manifestation of the need for fresh air. I think, if I can talk for a second about academia, I think that one of the most suffocating elements in academia is the need for specialization, the encouragement to tell people that you need to know everything about a minuscule part of the world, and that if you do so, you will be granted tenure and have a stable life.
Now, you got tenure at Amherst, and people describe you as a generalist.
I think that the word generalist is a positive adjective. I don't want to know everything about one particular corner of the world. I want to see different corners. I want to see how they connect with one another. I don't want to be living in that particular ghetto that it would be that corner. I think that the intellectual and the cultural critic and the writer is one that is able to travel through the mind from this part to that part. And that means that we don't want to be pinned down.
But it's this fragmentation of interests, of cultures, of identities that has given you pain in the past.
Sure, and because there is no cultural endeavor that doesn't bring with itself some sort of pain and some sort of treason as well. When you listed all those mirror-like words that I use to describe myself, imposter doesn't mean to me to be a traitor or
phony.
A phony. An imposter is a person who can live in different parts. I my father is an actor, and I have this admiration and envy for his profession.
But you've also said when you were young in your memoir that aspect of him made you very uncomfortable. You didn't know who the real father was. When is he your dad, and when is he somebody on stage?
Absolutely. I remember growing up and thinking, being very envious that on stage he would not be my father. And those 2 hours on stage would be a rest from being the person who he is. And that is impostorship. He was paid to be an imposter. He was paid to be a liar, and he supported the family thus.
You You're listening to ThoughtCast. I'm Jenny Atiya. With me is the author and literary critic Ilan Stavins, who's also a professor of Latin American and Latino culture at Amherst College and host of the PBS program La Plaza, Conversations with Ilan Stavins on WGBH Boston. There's much more to come. Stay with us. Ilan, one of your critiques of America is that it is not understanding of somebody like you.
Indeed, but on the other hand, I would say, Jenny, that this is an extraordinarily generous country. Here, you come because you know this is a factory of identities, that people reinvent themselves all the time. What is an immigrant if not a person who was X when she left Serbia and Y when she arrived in the United States, or Z when she left Chile, and T when she became an American in Los Angeles?
So we have alphabet soup.
We do, indeed. And an alphabet that is intriguing. I would describe it as a Babel or Babel-like alphabet soup. It's a country, particularly big cities like New York, to a lesser extent Chicago, L.A., where the plurality of languages is just invigorating. It is a country that is so allergic to languages, and yet you hear so many languages all the time in it.
It's in New York. You came to New York City when you were 24 from Mexico, that you first started to hear Spanglish.
Indeed, and fell in love with it. Languages result from necessity. Somebody needs to use them and needs to use them in that particular way, and thus they become current. And Spanglish has been looked down by intellectuals, by academics, as illegitimate, as contaminated, as impure. But all languages are impure at some stage, and they remain impure to some degree forever. And English was a Spanglish in the past. For me, looking at hearing or reflecting on Spanglish is like an astronomer discovering a new galaxy.
The Spanish have not responded that well to Spanglish.
Yeah, the Spanish from Spain, the Iberian Spanish speakers, are scandalized. They believe that Spanglish announces the decline and fall and probably demise of the Spanish language in this continent, not only in the United States, but in other parts of the hemisphere, and that for that reason, they need to do something and something quickly in order to bring it back to life. They are the doctors, forgetting, as they do, that the Spanish that we speak today in Mexico or in Argentina, in Colombia, in Puerto Rico, is a product of the age of colonialism, and that it has been adapted, contaminated, impurified by this exposure to the new environment. I think that in Latin America, Spanish became a mestizo language, mestizo being the word that describes the encounter between the aboriginal cultures and the Spaniards, and that Spanglish is a gorgeous expression, a lucid metaphor to that mestizo phenomenon, but now taking place north of the Rio Grande.
One of the subjects of your ire and critique is the Royal Spanish Academy, this august institution that's been there for centuries in charge of maintaining the purity of Spanish. You've written about it and you say that it tries to cleanse the language.
And cleanse is a very strong word for me. Cleanse is a word that brings me back to 1492, when the Spaniards eliminated from their midst the Jewish population, and eventually they would also expel the Muslim population, meaning that those that were different, that were unlike the Catholic majority, would not be accepted and would not be integrated and be allowed to be part of Spanish society. My discomfort has to do also with the institution of a royal academy and its mandate. It happens in France as well with the Académie Française. It happens in Italy. It happens in Israel. There is an institution in these countries that is endowed by the federal government to take the responsibility to legislate the language spoken by the people and to announce what is correct and what is not, what is allowed and what should be forbidden. When I think that language doesn't need those institutions. Language is free and the people are the keepers.
In Spanglish, your book, you say that you believe Spanglish is really becoming a new language, an American language within the larger America. Mm-hmm. So what are they saying?
People are saying words like marqueta and aplicar, marqueta for supermarket and aplicar for to apply rather than suscribirse or inscribirse. They are saying voy a parquear el automóvil, I am going to park the car, rather than voy a estacionar el automóvil. Or they are saying all sorts of expressions such as estoy friqueado, I'm freaked out, estoy estresado, I'm stressed out. There are equivalents in Spanish, and the purists say, well, if there are original words, if we can say estoy apesadumbrado, why say estoy estresado?
Because it's over.
Absolutely. And and because the first word that comes to our mind is the word that comes out. I think that Spanglish is gorgeous and it is the announcement of something new because it proves, against what many people say, that Latinos are looking for ways to become Americans, are immigrants with a big heart ready to integrate to this country, but with the baggage. And that is as it should be. Latinos are not, and I often get in trouble for saying this, Latinos are not a standard immigrant group. They are not like the Poles and like the Germans and like the Irish and like the Jews that came in the 19th century or in the early parts of the 20th century. They just come from the other side of the border. Part of the United States began in Spanish after the so-called conquest, better described as the encounter between the two cultures. The entire Southwest first used Spanish and then incorporated the English language in 1848.
So why is this point of view of yours getting you in trouble?
It gets me in trouble because people would like to think that Latinos will follow the exact same pattern that other immigrant waves had, that they will behave exactly like others did. But that becomes a formula, and that is not what life is about. Life is about surprises, and life is about changes. I believe we are witnessing a dramatic revolution in the United States, one that will utterly reshape what this country will be in the mid and end of the 21st century. I believe the principles of the Founding Fathers will remain intact, but so much of the texture, ethnic and cultural and gastronomic, educational, would be so different. The revolution is the result of both the Asians and the Hispanics coming to this country, not from Europe like most other immigrant groups have done in the past, but from other parts of the world with different tools and different dispositions and expecting other things from this country. And we have to learn what's going on in their minds rather than simply expect for them to behave the way everybody behaved in the past. The future is not that way.
As a critic, you analyze words, cultures, and you look at their underbelly, what's really going on. And as you've mentioned, you can get in some pretty hot water. There has been some criticism of you from other Latin American scholars. I know you're familiar with the comments. They seem to find you a little too big for your boots, that you're undeserving of your position, and that somehow you don't belong.
I think that a critic and an intellectual that doesn't get in trouble is not a useful one. I think what our role is to make people think differently, and to get, on occasion, in trouble.
Well, let's go back to this concept of the critic. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's say you have the proverbial horse. A critic looks the gift horse in the mouth and counts the teeth. Mm-hmm. And maybe there aren't any teeth and says so. Rather than being the owner or the buyer, the critic is objective.
Absolutely. And I'll go a little beyond and use another metaphor, Jenny. I believe that democracy as a system of life cannot exist without critics. They are that important. Ideas are important when they are presented in front of us as if in a marketplace, when they are sharpened, when they are placed in context. And who does that but the critic?
However, the criticisms that have been directed to you from Latin American scholars have really stressed that you really weren't here in America when the Chicano movement was huge. It's not part of who you are. And somehow, I'm using my own words here, you really haven't earned your stripes. What is your response to what sounds to me like somebody saying, you're not one of us, therefore you can't comment? You have no right to comment.
Let me begin by saying I don't know if I want to become one of us. My desire is not to become one of us. My desire is to be here and participate and look at the larger spectrum of things. If I want to become one of us, it is not of one particular group, but of a larger, abstract, universal sense of community. One of the biggest handicaps of Hispanic intellectual, the Hispanic intellectual tradition, is that unlike certain cultures that come from Europe in particular, we didn't have an enlightenment process. And we don't really know what the critic needs to do. Latin America has had so much trouble with democracy because it doesn't know what to do with dissent. Dissent is often decapitated, assassinated, or exiled, rather than incorporated into the marketplace of politics or of intellectual debate.
Ilan, you've said in the past that a sickness of ethnicity and ethnic pride is now dominating the academy. Your ethnicity is perhaps confusing to people. You are culturally Hispanic, but you don't look Hispanic. Mm-hmm. Is this part of the problem?
I don't think it's a problem.
To your critics?
It might be. It doesn't matter to me.
I want to hold your feet to the fire for a moment by quoting you in an article. You said, being Hispanic doesn't mean having brown skin or having the last name Rodriguez.
Right.
That's a defensive statement.
Is it? No.
You're saying, I'm tired of being told that I have to be to have brown skin or have the last name Rodriguez, really, to be authentic, to have the credibility of a critic.
I would love to be able to be for a week a Rodriguez and have brown skin. It would give me a sense of life that probably would enrich me. We are who we are, unapologetically so. And had I been a Rodriguez and had brown skin, I'm sure my perspective would be different. It would be rich in so many different ways, poor in so many different ways, the way mine is rich or poor. There is this attempt by, particularly in the 80s, I think it has receded somewhat, by the Latino community of creating a unified, homogeneous sense of identity by collapsing color and national background. But what makes us beautifully creative as Latinos is the fact that we come from all sorts of backgrounds, that we are Rodriguez and Perez, but also Berbovsky and Fujimori. And those we are, in so many ways, what America always wanted to be, a multiplicity of identities, a bonfire of possibilities. And there's no apology.
This multiplicity, this celebration of difference that you represent in many ways and would like the U.S. to be, if it isn't already, really comes in contrast with how you see, at least, the academy. You are a public intellectual engaged with the present.
Yes, you know, for me, you might find it interesting or funny. For me, the word academic is a derogatory noun or adjective, depending on how you use it.
Well, people say, oh, that's academic.
That's academic. Or he, and when they say he's an academic, you know, they might be really say he's a scholar, but an academic comes to me with all this baggage of kind of isolating yourself from the rest of society.
Perhaps part of your ambivalence or discomfort with being an academic yourself has something to do with the fact that you'd really like to also be a writer of literary fiction.
Maybe, yes. I dreamed when I was a young man first of being a filmmaker and then of being a novelist. I wanted to be a novelist of the size and of the ambition of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, of Mario Vargas Llosa. I never thought I would end up in academia. I never thought I would end up the person that I ended up being. I never thought I would come to the United States and kind of reinvent myself anew.
So we've now defined you. You are now an academic. You've just said so.
Maybe. And yet, at the same time, it is, as I was telling you before, you do what you can with what is at your disposal.
In your memoir, you wrote, quote, "Isn't the art of growing up the art of revamping our dreams?"
Yes.
How is that process going?
Let me just switch it a little bit, but pursuing that thought. The word maturity for me is, I think a lot about it. Maturity for me is the capacity of not being the same person 2 minutes from now, and yet being exactly the same. And in that transformation, in those 2 minutes, hoping that there is some sort of improvement.
It may be an odd metaphor, but it sounds to me like a form of Darwinian evolution.
It could be. I would put it a little different. I would say that you don't do anything but write your own epitaph. You're looking for that way you want to be remembered. Remembrance, memory, is the most elusive of all human endeavors. And who is to say what will be remembered tomorrow and what will be forgotten? But you put your little dime, hoping that at least your life will not be wasted, because there will be something good coming out of it for others.
How would you write your epitaph now, Ilan?
I would try to convey in stone silence. But silence cannot be conveyed without the sense that there's nothing there, and I want something to be there that is silence, and I don't know what it is. For me, death is about the disappearance of languages, but that comes after languages have been used. I don't know exactly. I don't know how to respond to that question.
Your epitaph then would be the complete opposite of who you are.
Absolutely.
You are not a silent
person. Not a silent person. I am not a loud person in any way. I'm also not an angry person. And I suffer from being an optimist.
As an optimist, are you hoping to find your home?
No. I want to live in rented homes. I love, I actually should tell you that in real life I owe a couple. But metaphorically, no, I don't have this obsession with having what you were saying. How do you define yourself? I don't feel the need to have a home. I'm perfectly comfortable wherever I find myself and try to make the best out of that place in intellectual terms.
Have you found an intellectual home?
Yes, I found New England. It is a place where ideas are respected.
Well, Cervantes must be rolling in his grave right now.
Well, we can read Cervantes in New England. In translation or in the original.
Well, Ilan, that's a wrap. We're done.
Wonderful questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to author and literary critic Ilan Stavins talk about his new book, Dictionary Days. And this is ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.